here come a German reconnaissance plane, fighter plane. I always remember how big that propeller was. But anyway, he comes zoom right across about 100 feet up, maybe 150 feet up, taking pictures, evidently. Well, this anti-aircraft guns, they were spread out all over, so they all start running back to the guns. Time they all got back there and the sergeant got back there. Why? I'll give you, this is a timeline, because it's kind of, vroom! Boom, 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 boom! And they're shooting straight up in the air. This guy's 40 miles down the road.
I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes, a podcast dedicated to honoring the brave men and women who allow us to enjoy the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. Each Tuesday, I'll sit down with an incredible military hero. We will listen to unedited, authentic stories in their own voices, in their own words. We will hear incredible military stories from some of the greatest heroes to ever walk the face of this earth. And who knows, we may even learn a few of their secret life lessons along the way. Although none of us can begin to imagine what they've seen, heard, and experienced, during our time together, I'll do my very best to take us all for a walk among heroes. Here we go. I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes podcast, episode 29A, with Mr. Morris Buck Buckman of our very own Dripping Springs, Texas. Right here in just outside of Austin, just north of San Antonio, Dripping Springs, small little community, just an amazingly tight-knit group of people, very supportive of our military there in Hays County. And Mr. Buckman moved to Dripping Springs in the past few years. His family lives there. And he was part of the 87th Infantry Division, 345th Regiment. Not many people know much about the 87th Infantry Division. You hear a lot about, of course, you hear a lot about Third Army and General Patton and those units there. But when we talked to Mr. Clinton, you may remember in a previous podcast episode, he was part of the 84th Infantry Division, the rail splitter division. And the 87th was known as the Acorn Division, as it had, it was the unit patch was a green circle with a yellow acorn in the middle of it, which not many people know. And I always think of these 80-something divisions. Whenever I hear somebody was part of the 80-whatever division, whether it be the 84th, 87th, I always think Battle of the Bulge. And those divisions arrived in Europe, you know, sort of towards the latter part of 1944. So they arrived just in time for the Battle of the Bulge. And those divisions were sent to the front lines to relieve many of those the units that had been involved in the invasion of Normandy and then fought all the way through Europe. And then here come these 80-something divisions, and boom, they get thrown to the front lines just in time for the Battle of the Bulge. And so for the 87th specifically, they deployed in October of 1944 from New York, and they arrived in Le Havre, France, in November of 1944. Well, we all know that the Battle of the Bulge took place in December 1944. So literally, these are brand new units, you know, the 87th in this case, that was sent to the front lines, and right away, boom, they walked right into a bulldozer as the Germans were coming through and attacking as part of the Battle of the Bulge, which became the largest battle that our military has ever faced in history. Mr. Buckman was part of the 345th Regiment, which they took the large brunt of many of those attacks. He was actually, it turned out to be a stroke of luck, but he was hurt in a training accident early on, and they tried to pull him out and take him away from his unit. And he told the doctors and whatnot, no, I really want to stay with my unit. So they allowed him to stay with his unit, and they made him a transportation officer, which meant that for much of the war, he was, you know, behind the front lines a little bit, and that really saved his life. In his words, that one incident caused him to save his life. Now, of course, he could have just completely gotten out of it, you know, when he was injured, but he wanted to stay with his unit. He wanted to deploy, and he wanted to go fight, and so that's what he did. In July of 1945, which was after, you know, VE Day, we declared victory in Europe, the 87th redeployed back to the United States with the specific purpose of training to go fight in Japan. So they redeployed in July of 1945 with the understanding that they were going to go to Fort Benning, train, and then deploy to Japan right away for the invasion of Japan. And obviously, Mr. Buckman is very thankful that the Enola Gay was able to successfully deliver the goods on Hiroshima, and that he never had to go over there. But just an amazing man, very, very humble man. And this connection was actually made to a very dear friend of mine, Kyle, who lives in Dripping Springs. And Kyle was part of this conversation we had. There's a little bit of background noise, and I apologize. We were in the retirement home. It was sort of a public place there. But Kyle made the introduction. He's also a steward of World War II history and just an amazing guy. So this is a two-part episode. Part A will consist of basically Mr. Buckman's his childhood, going into the military training, and then his time in World War II. And then episode two, part B, will be more of just a conversation back and forth, some other really interesting stories from Mr. Buckman's life. I talk a little bit in there. I don't usually, when I meet with these veterans, I talk a fair amount. As we're talking about military, I talk about my time in the Army and what we did over in Iraq and things like that. But I usually end up cutting that out of the podcast because it's not, you know, you're here to listen to these World War II veterans. But in part B, I left a lot of that in. So if anybody's interested in hearing about, you know, what we did in Iraq and that sort of thing, you can catch some of that in part B as part of the conversation with Mr. Buckman, as well as some of his lessons learned for just life in general. And, you know, the same questions we usually ask to provide advice to younger folks and that sort of thing. So hope you enjoy this conversation. He's an amazing man. I just turned 100, I guess, 2 years ago now. So he's going strong. These guys, I just admire all of them, but Mr. Buckman is one of the best, and it was an absolute honor to meet him. Please, if as always, please continue to share this, spread it around. Really want to thank everybody for listening and sharing these stories. Without further ado, here's Mr. Buckman.
It's. I think you're like me and my grandfather. I didn't ask him questions when I should have. And I've been wondering about a lot of things ever since.
Well, you're exactly right. And there's not a day that goes by with my grandfather and my father that I didn't talk to them more. And my dad passed away in 2009, and then my grandfather passed away in 2011. And I really, after he passed away, that's what sparked this whole adventure.
Now, one of them is in Korea, you said?
My grandfather fought in World War II, and then my dad fought in Korea and Vietnam. And then I was in the Army as well, and in these hard to call them wars after, you know, what you went through, but I was overseas in the desert.
Were you? A couple of times. You saw some.
We did. A little different, though, than you know. It's hard to call those wars, but we were in combat. We'll put it that way.
We were in combat. You had things you didn't know what was underneath of you sometimes.
Things coming at you quickly, shooting at you. But that was it. And then Kyle had mentioned, actually last year, he had mentioned you. And I thought, well, sure, it would be good to sit down and talk to you at some point. And then, of course, we were in the middle of the COVID situation. So, anyway, it's just great to finally meet you. I always like to, if possible, just start a little bit with your childhood and where you grew up. And I think it's also interesting to talk about, you guys dealt with a lot when you were growing up. It was not, you know, nowadays things are provided and handed, you know, it was much different because you were growing up during the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And so I always love to hear and also share those stories about, you know, your youth and when you were growing up and what you went through. So if you could just start and talk a little bit about your childhood.
Okay. I was born first in Kansas. It's simple. It's right in the middle of the state of Kansas. My dad was a wheat farmer, and then he turned into a dairy farmer. But my oldest sister was born deaf. And so when she started school at 6 years old, death school was in Olathe, Kansas, which is eastern Kansas, by Kansas City. So she thought the family was giving her away when they sent her off to school. And so the next year, my mother said, I'm not sending that girl off to school. I'm going to get an apartment back there in Olathe. My dad, he couldn't rent the farm without her, so they sold out the farm. We all moved to Olathe when I was 5 years old, which was not too bad. But he was kind of like a fish out of water. He was a dairy farmer and a farmer, and he was trying to sell feed and do things that he wasn't really trained to do. But so we didn't. The Depression years were tough on us. But, I didn't know it at the time, of course. Everybody else was poor, but
you don't know it because everybody's going through the same situation.
I can truthfully say I've gone hungry. My mother's much. Idol because she laughed through it. And I know it's been tough. When you got kids that are hungry, you haven't had anything to feed them. But anyway, my dad had a, there was two newspapers in Kansas City, Kansas City Star and the Kansas City Journal Post. And he had the route for the Journal Post, which was both of them two-a-day paper, morning and evening. And then the Kansas City Star was a better paper, so they cut out the morning paper and the post, so just the afternoon. Anyway, I delivered papers from the time I was 8 years old until I think high school. But anyway, they were tough years, but when you're a kid, you're all fun years. So.
Sure.
So after I got out of high school, I didn't have enough money to go to college, so I went to work in a hunt and polo club as a stable hand. you got to check me off because I get off on all these side stories. It's interesting.
No, this is interesting to me. My wife she rides horses. That's her hobby. So anything horse related is very interesting to me.
This was an interesting job. As a stable hand, you aren't exactly on top of the world, but they had during the winter, they'd have once a week, they'd have the fox hunt. Which is really something. I don't know if you've ever been at a fox hunt with all the red coats and all dressed up and the hounds everywhere, about 1,000, seemed like 25 hounds. And the guy, the past master hound, he'd blowing his horn. And it's something spectacular to see. They arrange this in Kansas City, from the suburbs. So they arrange with farmers around the area that we can cross their territory and jump the fences and all that stuff. So the guy we had a fox up in the loft of the barn there in a pen, burlap sacks all over the place. And of course, the fox would leak all over, and then he would take that and drag to make the trail for the fox hunt. And he was a Polish guy. I don't know, you've got to get sick of my stories, but I never went with him on his landing trail, but he had a certain route he'd follow and try to change it every week so they wouldn't be jumping the same thing. And one day he's laying a trail and he made a mistake and made a big loop. And of course, when he looped back, when the dogs came up, they picked up the new trail. And he's up a tree because he heard them coming after him, so he climbed the tree, tied his horse up and climbed the tree. I didn't get to see it. I'd love to see it. But anyway, I always loved that fox hunt because it was something spectacular. All those people got there on their horses.
That's quite the event. I mean, I've seen videos, and it's still a tradition. They still do it today. It's big. Yeah, everybody dresses up.
Oh yeah, it's big in England. I think more so than here. But it was always something. And then, of course, when you went on fox hunt, you use polo land. So we the polo grounds. Well, we had one there at the farm, but the meet every Sunday was at Country Club in Kansas City, and we had stable hands. And you'd have to get four horses ready: one to ride and three to drag and lead. We didn't have to go all the way, probably 4 or 5 miles into Tennessee, leaving point ponies. And of course, that the matches are where we bring them all back. But polo watching is kind of fun. I never tried to do it. I'd get on a horse and try to hit it, but I couldn't hit the thing. I'd hit the horse. But it was always kind of fun.
Some talented people and talented horses.
Oh, yeah, you bet they are. Yeah, I love to ride a polo pony. You ride it like a stick, an airplane stick. You know. They'll put you in the back seat if you shove that stick forward real quick. You know where they're from. But anyway, I'm drifting off again.
What year did you graduate high school?
This is 38.
38, okay.
So in 39, I got a job in the summertime shoveling green out of boxcars with a power shovel. I won't give them that long story, but anyway, one of the places I worked for a couple of weeks was at General Mills in Kansas City. And to get to the elevator to my job, I had to walk between two big buildings. They were mills, and I didn't know anything about milling. But there's all that noise coming out of each one of them, and I wondered what's going on in there. So Kansas State University had a milling school. I didn't know anything about the time, but it was the only school in the country. There was a school in Russia, but the only school in the country in milling was at Kansas State. And somehow or another, I got wind of it, and I applied, and they'd only take 15 freshmen a year. But I had pretty good grades in high school, so they took me, and so I got into milling business. Unbeknownst what I'm doing, of course, but I guess we all go through that.
It happens.
But anyway, I ended up my Army thing. Really, I go to all this to get to Kansas State with a land grant, like A&M.
Sure.
So yeah, the first two years you had to take ROTC.
Gotcha.
And the second 2 years you had an option. So anyway, I ended up in the advanced course of ROTC because they paid $7 a month. And $7 was big back then.
It was a big deal.
Yeah. And, but of course, the war started in 41, and we were told in the spring of 42 we had to go to summer school.
Where were you in December 7, 1941? Where were you?
I was in school.
Okay.
Yeah. And we were told they had to go to summer school in 42 because they were going to take us in 43. So in February of 43, we were told all of the advanced ROTC were told to go to the officer training school. So we went to Fort Leavenworth and got outfitted and ended up in Fort Benning, Georgia. And after about three months wonders. They always call them 90-day wonders. But after about 6 weeks, you go out on a problem, they have a big bleacher thing, and they give you a problem, and you're supposed to run out there and come back and write down what your solution was. And I jumped over a ditch and sprained me. Well, pulled my foot back, way back, and broke some bones. So they hauled me off to the dispensary and said, "We want you back there at 1 o'clock. Can't tell you why, but want you back there at 1 o'clock. So they put me on crutches and I go back at 1 o'clock. All it was Franklin Roosevelt was in Fort Benning and was coming by to look at everything going, and so he drives by in his big old open air thing, his big long cigarette, he was saying that thing. Waves, and that was it.
That's quite an honor to be that close to.
Well, I got to see a president anyway.
That's right. That's right.
But anyway, that's the start of my troubles with the Army, because I had to drop out of my class. I was in the OC class I was in with all my buddies at school. Probably a fourth of them were all my buddies, and there's about 200 in this class. But I had to drop out because I was crippled, and I was out for a month and put back in another class and got out of OCS in June of 43. June 43. And went from there to Fort McClellan, Alabama, to a replacement pool, which was an education. Up until then, the Army was turning down anybody who had gonorrhea or syphilis. And in the South, of course, you still had the Jim Crow stuff down there, and all the white guys had been taken off the Army, and the black guys were staying home, and so the white parents were yelling, and they started taking black people, even if they had syphilis or gonorrhea. So that's what I ended up in a replacement battalion with one third of the occupants, either with syphilis or gonorrhea.
Oh, geez. Wow.
And so you had, they had the individual huts, eight to a hut.
Yeah.
The latrine area was separate for the ones affected. There's another education. Up until then, I had no biases, but I developed bias in a hurry. But I don't know if my whole long story on that. But anyway, I finally got out of there to go to Camp McCain, Mississippi, to join the 87th Division. And I was assigned to a service company and ended up as regimental transportation officer. Well, after about, well, we went to maneuvers in Tennessee. In this fall of winter 43.
Fall of 43, probably.
Fall and winter of 43, yeah. And then we ended up in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And then they sent me to the General Hospital in Augusta, Georgia, because I was still crippled around. Actually, they thought I was malingering, and I could see why they might think it, because I was crippled, and I wasn't getting any better. Well, the hospital in Augusta, Georgia, they put me through a bunch of tests and everything. They said, no, you got something wrong here. We don't know what it is, but x-ray didn't show anything. So they finally got to the point, they said, I'm going to give you limited duty, send me back someplace. I said, no, I don't want limited duty. Send me home, or I want to go back to my outfit. Well, which you want? So I want to go back to my outfit. So they said, okay. So they sent me back to the 87th Division, and a week before we were to go overseas. So I had to rush around and get clothing in. And one thing I... Forgive me for all these side trips, but...
No, I love these. No, please.
The officers there, they're good friends, of course, good friends. They said, go work this certain warehouse and get yourself a 45 gun. There's a carbine was your standard issue. And said, but you got to take something to trade for it. I don't know. I still don't know what the situation was. This guy, the warehouse has gotten a shipment of 45s that they hadn't ordered and trying to get rid of them, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, I got a new field jacket, took it over and traded it for a gun. But, so I carried this 45 all through Germany. But anyway, I only had a week to get ready. And then we ended up in New Jersey to go see. And that was in October of 44.
44.
Yeah, 44.
And the 87th Division was the acorn patch.
Right.
So the picture on their patch is an acorn.
Now, how'd you know that?
I study. I'm kind of a nerd when it comes coming to the divisions, but I always associate the 87th and the 84th in my mind. The 84th was the rail splitter division. They used to call it the Lincoln Division. And you guys were very close in terms of the Battle of Bulge, where you're at, and that sort of thing. But anyway, I always remember that the 87th is, in my mind, the Acorn Division.
Reading that, kind of asked you, there was a guy here, actually he died here about a week ago, but he was an agent. What do you call these guards for the president and so forth?
Secret Service.
Secret Service, some kind. And he was a nut on patches. He knew every division there was, and so he knew all about it.
And the 87th was the 345th, 346th, 347th regiments,
right? Okay, you
good. Got it. Which one were you assigned at that point?
I went to McCain, Mississippi.
Okay.
I was assigned to 345.
Okay.
So I stayed with them after I came back in the hospital and went back, but I was still at 345. So anyway, we ended up, we went off over in the Queen Elizabeth. We had to have...
How long did they keep you at Camp Kilmer before they...
Just practically 2 days.
Okay.
Yeah. It's time to go in New York and act like we were big shots or something. Anyway, we had blimp coverage for 300 miles or something. And the Queen Elizabeth was all its own because it'd go fast enough. You look back in the wake, you're going like this all the way across. But it ended up in Biddulph, Scotland. And then, not Biddulph, Scotland, Glasgow. And then we ended up in Biddulph, England, which is southeast of Liverpool by about 30 miles, a little town. And we were there until we went over to Europe in October. Somewhere in that area, October. I've got a 345, well, I haven't any more. My grandson's got a 345th book with all this stuff.
All the dates.
But anyway, we were in Biddulph about 3 months before we went over to Europe. And we went up to, of course, D-Day is over with, and we went up to Rouen. I was on an LST.
Where did you land?
In Rouen, R-O-U-E-N. I guess that's the way you spell it. It's up the Seine River about, I don't know, you go like this.
Sure.
I think it's probably 80 kilometers or something like that.
Okay.
And we disembarked there, camped out in the woods there for a couple of days. Again, side trip. It was in the old World War I battlefield area. And the trenches, they were still there, but they wasn't, of course, went up and down like that. They're all caved in there.
Interesting.
So I'm going to go exploring around this old, kind of interested about the old war, but when you've been since the Sergeant York and all these World War I pictures. And I was walking around by myself out there in the wilds, and a grouse took off. Well, they make more racket when they take off than a locomotive. And I thought the whole German army attacked them. I said, why am I doing out here in the woods by myself? But anyway, forget all the side trips.
No, we love the side story. Little did you know the whole German army would be attacking you in about another month.
So there we stayed a few days there, and then we went to Metz, France. Metz, France was they went to the Siegfried line yet, but they were past Metz. But Metz had a big fort up on a hill that controlled the highways, intersections. And they were still in German hands, and so he had to live this to be appreciated. But I wasn't part of the Tom convoy, so I didn't pay attention how we were getting there. We ended up in Metz, France at 2 o'clock in the morning, and artillery was flying everywhere, right over the top of us. Well, the fort was right above us. Artillery, I don't know, every gun in the country, I think, the back there, because there wasn't when the time, there wasn't the artillery shell, I thought I was in the middle of the war right away. And I didn't know who was shooting at who.
Oh, you don't know, yeah.
No, nobody said, here you are. You know, of course, you soon find out nothing's hitting you. So it's come to find out it was our artillery firing on this fort trying to put it out of commission. And so it was a good place to kind of give the guys a taste of war, I guess, because they tried to move up on the fort, and we only stayed there.
They were extremely dug in there at Metz, right? I mean, it was tough to uproot the Germans out of there.
Oh, yeah, you can bash them out.
You can pound
them out. About the way you do. Yeah. They had high ground. But anyway, we only stayed there less than a week, and then made a few excursions up the hill and so forth just to give them a taste. And, of course, just that artillery flying all the time gave you a taste of war, but... So from there we moved down to Saar Valley. I don't know just where, I think it was about 30 miles north of the Swiss border, somewhere in there.
And you were part of the Third Army at this point?
You know, most of the time we were. Okay. They switched us back and forth, and you never knew. Somebody have to tell you, well, you're not a part of the 12th or something.
They were shifting you around.
Basically, we were, most of the time, I think 90% of the time, we were in Third Army.
Okay.
So then we were down in Saar Valley, and we were attacked in Siegfried Line. We were only there probably 3 weeks before the bullets started. And again, another side story that tickled the devil on me now when I think back on it. I was leading the convoy, and of course you're sprung out when you're close to combat, like you've got a lot of space between vehicles, and so I'm probably 3 miles long back there. And I'm parked right next to an anti-tank battery. Well, one gun unit, call it battery, one gun unit. And four black guys running an aircraft gun. Well, they had nothing going on, so they're wandering off, and there's one guy left, and the sergeant, three snipers down there someplace. And so I'm sitting in the jeep waiting to get me the orders over to put everybody. And here come a German reconnaissance plane, fighter plane. I always remember how big that propeller was. But anyway, he kept zoom right across about 100 feet up, maybe 150 feet up, taking pictures, evidently. Well, this anti-aircraft guns, they were spread out all over, so they all start running back to the guns. Time they all got back there and the sergeant got back there, I'll give you, this is a timeline, because it's kind of, vroom! Boom, 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 boom! And they're shooting straight up the air. This guy's 40 miles down the road. Anyway, it's one of those things. How the hell are we winning this war?
Wow.
Anyway, and that was kind of a sad episode down there because we weren't told how close we were to the front line. And I know we were on a bare hill. And C Company, and I got a little another story on C Company, but I'll tell it now. C Company was captained by Captain Comer, who was a West Pointer.
Okay.
And he was strictly West Point. He didn't do anything wrong. Excellent captain, but he wanted to be a professor at West Point. And he knew the only way you'd be a professor was to be a captain in combat. You can't teach anybody how to do it if you haven't been there. And so he passed up, like I said, I don't know how many professors have told me he did pass up, because he wanted to stay a captain and get in combat so he could teach at West Point. But they didn't tell us where we were, so C Company right below us, from here to the far wall over there, and they're lining up for lunch. Instead of being spread out, nobody shows sure. We're close, and they're both shoulder to shoulder.
Everybody's bunched up.
So 88 started coming in and wiped out a whole trailer full of them. I was gone at the time. I was back getting something else way back someplace. When I got back, they told me that this 88 had shot C Company to pieces.
Whew.
And I happen to know two twins that were in C Company. And when we all maneuvered, they needed somebody to take the stockade, the guys in the stockade, on maneuvers. So I'm available, I guess, because they put me in charge of stockade. And so I had eight soldiers guarding these. I had about eight POWs, I call them. One of them was a radical German kid, and so he was our main problem because if he got away, we had to serve our time. But anyway, these two twins, Italian boys from New York City, nicest kids there were. They were two of them wiped out on that attack.
And, oh, man.
What bugs me most about it, in the 345 history book, there's nothing said about it.
Wow.
There's no names in there of them or anything. And the big goof up by the upper guys, and they didn't want anybody to question it, I guess. I don't know. All I know is their names as being deceased are not in there. But
that's really interesting. I've noticed just from talking to veterans that there are a fair number of those inconsistencies where the leadership, you know, makes a mistake or something, and then all of a sudden it's wiped from the record books.
No history on it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you didn't understand.
Right.
Nobody really knows what's going on, I guess. But
no, it's right. Chaos.
But anyway, from the Saar Valley, we stayed down there a couple of weeks, and then the bulge started. And so we were pulled out to go to the bulge.
Mid-December time frame.
This is, I remember the day before Christmas Eve. We were in, I think it's Nancy, France, somewhere up there on the way to the bulge. And we were traveling, so I had eaten a can of ham and eggs that wasn't good. And we put our bedrolls in what they call a 48 car. Some farmer bought a box car and put it on his land there to put stuff in. And so we had taken that over to put our bedrolls in. And I was a back end. My start boiling. I got to get out to throw up. I got to step over all these other soldiers, all these other officers. And I remember standing out there in the snow, bare feet. This is a hell of a way to spend Christmas Eve. But anyway, we went. So we went. We got to the bulge area on Christmas Day. And I always remember now Ed Clements, his dad was there, and Cardinway, I got it from him. His dad was kind of like a clerk in the company headquarters. Good at typewriter and taking notes and so forth, but he got bomb hit a building and what fell down and hurt him. Something, I think, I remember the story. He got hurt by stuff falling on him. And so he's going out in an ambulance the day we're coming in. That's our combination.
Amazing.
His dad's going out and I'm going in. So, but
Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
Battle of the Bulge, here we come.
The next day is when it started. So, but, we got in combat there, and the bulge had stopped. It was a matter of shoving them back, and we spent about 10 days there. And then we were pulled out to go to Luxembourg for R&R, which turned out kind of odd because we were being hit by it. What do you call this? 60s and 81s. Mortars. And the black semi drivers that haul us around at that time, they were trying to take off all the time. They didn't like that. Anyway, another side story. But then when we went back, that's when we really got in the thick of it because we lost a lot of people in that final push to the Siegfried line.
So you basically stopped the Germans. Your job, your regiment's job during the bulge was to stop them and push them back,
right.
And get back to the original.
Now, I wasn't a line soldier, so I'm...
Oh, you were in plenty of...
I'm a single. All my officers were married, had family. Well, not had family, they had a wife.
Yeah.
And so every time they wanted something in front, you go. So I spent some time on the front, a lot more than I should have, I guess.
Than you wanted to.
Yeah. But I, you got to, anybody I appreciate is that GI shoulder that lived in that, but it didn't have foxholes. You didn't have foxholes. You had a pit that up this long, just for long enough for two guys to lay down in the bedrooms. And it was covered with logs because the tree burst is what you got you, so you had to cover your pit with logs. You kind of roll into it. You lay down and roll into your foxhole or call.
Because in the bulge, they would fire the artillery rounds and they would strike the trees up top, higher up, which would then basically just rain shrapnel down on
everybody. That was a big fear. Yeah. So but they'd live in that hole for, well, we waited, let's see, we got back there about the 14th of January, 14th of January. We didn't take off for across Germany till March, so we almost 2 months they lived in that damn hole like that.
And it was nice and warm in Europe during that time, right? I'm kidding.
The worst winter
Europe's ever seen.
It was really cold, that's when they decreed you had to rub your buddy's feet twice a day to keep from getting frostbite.
And a lot of guys with frostbite and trench foot and snow. I've seen some pictures and it looked just horrible.
Yeah, it's not good. Anyway, finally took off and it was not much, very little fighting went on. 345th took Koblenz, so there were four up at the top of the hill in the middle of Koblenz. It was a problem as far as the city streets. Everybody just kind of gave up and puts out a white sheet, and you didn't have to do a whole lot of house clearing. It took a couple of days to take down this fort, and then we went, moved down south of Koblenz to a place called Boppert. I remember the name because in the Stars and Stripes, a local paper account, once a week, it shows Patton taking a piss in the Rhine, and he's going to show the German he's pissing in the Rhine. But it was that bopper after we passed.
Interesting.
So we stayed in Boppert for a few days, and engineers put a pontoon across the Rhine, and then we took off.
And then it was the breakout, and then you were off.
It was jump. 20 miles here, 10 here. We had a few, you never knew where the line was. I remember one time we were about halfway across Germany and I was leading a convoy of trucks and jeeps and we were told to move to a certain town up here. Come to the road junction and Major Olson, the battalion commander of the 3rd Battalion, he saw me in the command car. And we pull up there, and he says, where are you going? And I said, well, we're going to such and such a town. He said, we haven't been through there yet. I said, well, that's where we're told to go. So, well, go ahead. He said, we haven't been through there. So we go up and I organized a Bergenreich marker to get all the guns and everything in the town. And we moved everybody else, moved the Germans over to a certain section of town we'd take over. But that's the only time I got in front of the line.
That's right. Thankfully, they were one of the towns that surrendered.
Oh, yeah, there was no fighting.
Waving the white sheet.
I always remember the one guy calling guns and binoculars and cameras, and you had to put them in this house and lock it up and put your name on it because, we didn't know what we were doing. But anyway, this one village idiot, he come up with a broken BB gun. So hadn't fired in 20 years. He has got this old rusty BB gun. He's turned in this rusty BB gun. And all the local villages, they're all laughing about it. Come with a BB gun.
How did the German people treat you when you were coming into these villages? Were they?
Of course, we never had contact,
right?
We'd boot them out and
move through
and take over their house what we wanted, and really no contact. They was all ready to give up.
They knew they were.
We ended up in Czechoslovakia, of course. The line drawn by the Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill was back there way back. He was going fast. Of course, Patton, he always wanted to say he had in his head he's going to go to Moscow.
Yeah.
I don't know. You read about it. But
so you went past the Elbe.
Oh, we went way past.
Way past, yeah.
We were over in Czechoslovakia.
Wow.
Stayed there a month probably. We were the first division back to go to Japan.
That's right, because the 87th was pulled out with the intention of
we came back to Fort Benning to be outfitted for Japan.
Yeah, they were pulled out with the intention of immediately going for the invasion of Japan.
Lucky you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that big bomb.
The Enola Gay was your good friend.
Yeah, that would have been
Do you remember where you were when you remembered Germany surrendering? When you heard that Germany had surrendered?
Yeah, we were in Czechoslovakia.
I mean, do you remember, did they tell you? Did they run in and tell you? I was just curious.
Well, you knew it was over with. Right? Even being in Czechoslovakia, yeah. It was over with. But, no, I don't.
Okay, I was just curious. I was curious what the mood of the... Like, at that point, did you know that... Were there rumors that you would be potentially going to Japan, or is that something you found out later?
No, we didn't know that until... we pulled out of Czechoslovakia. Of course, we had to get back to the Russians and complain about us being in their territory.
Right.
So they pulled us back right away to one of those camps in France that got you ready to come back to the United States. Camp Lucky Strike or something like they called it. And we didn't know. Well, we knew when we went back to Camp Lucky Strike, to be sent back to the States. We were the first division. They told us we were the first division to go back to the outfit from Japan.
What were you thinking at that point?
Well, I'm just getting glad to get back to the States. I worry about Japan.
One day at a time. Yeah, one day at a time.
Yeah. I was fortunate and that I hurt my ankle. I think I wouldn't be here if I hurt my ankle. I'd have been a line soldier, a line lieutenant.
That's why they made you the transportation officer.
Yeah, basically, I couldn't be a line officer.
Yeah.
And so, and I think that saved my life.
Yeah.
Because so many of my buddies that were line officers didn't come back.
That division, I remember, I don't remember the exact number. The 87th, but there were a tremendous number of casualties.
You know, and I read
6,000, maybe 7,000.
Read some journal who was coming over all things said that the 87th never got their due for their bulge combat.
I agree.
The other generals were better PR than them.
Well, you know, all the credit for the bulge goes to Bastogne. People, when the average American, if they even know what the Battle of the Bulge is, and they hear about the Battle of the Bulge, they think of Bastogne, right, and they think about nuts. McAuliffe saying nuts, that's what the average, but that was the largest military battle that our nation's ever been involved in.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, yeah, right.
The largest battle we've ever been involved in, and the sheer magnitude of that battle with the number of divisions that Germany invaded, came through the Ardennes with maybe 100 and some divisions, I think, something like that. Ridiculous number, 30 side. I don't remember the exact number, but it was just a massive number of troops and hit our forces with a, unbelievable.
Wipe that out.
And had it not been for you guys, for the 84th, nobody knows much about the 87th, nobody knows much about the 84th, but the two of your divisions ended up sort of stopping the whole advance and pushing them back, and nobody knows anything about them. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows anything about them. So I think that's...
It's kind of odd because in my trips up to the, what I call the front line, I'd always be picking up some dead soldier. And 106th was when I took the brunt of that first bulge. And this German farmer hailed me down and yapping something about some guy out here in the field. So my driver and I, we go out there, and there's a 106 soldier out there in the weeds, and the weeds are that high. And he's frozen stiff. And I always remember he had a 5-pound box of chocolate stuck in his field jacket. And so I picked him up and put him on the hood of the Jeep and took him. The barrel of vision was part of the service company. So you pick up somebody, you take them back to where we were and turn them over to the barrel unit. And off I'm wondering, saying, well, what was he doing out in the middle of that field, buried? And I think he froze to death out there. I think he got separated, or maybe separated himself, and got out and hid those weeds or something and froze to death. I don't know. I often wonder, why was he out in the middle of that field and buried in the weeds all by himself? His rifle was gone. He didn't have a rifle. I don't know.
You think about, too, the sheer number of people from all these different backgrounds and ethnicities that came together that one place in time, you know, in December 1944. Just the sheer number of people that came together to fight in that battle, and all of the individual circumstances, and that was just, the conditions were, at least from everything I've read and understand, just horrible. The winter, the cold, the snow, the ice, just horrible conditions. Of course, Germany was trying to sort of replicate what they had done years earlier, you know, when they invaded France initially. And luckily, guys like you were around to stop
it. You know, I've read that Eisenhower asked Hodges how soon he could get 3 divisions.
Yeah.
And he said something about a week or something like that. And he asked Patton, he said 3 days. And that's why we ended up there.
Yeah. Well, you know, Eisenhower receives a lot of criticism. Not criticism, but Eisenhower is often viewed as a more of a manager, you know, versus a master tactician, like a Patton, you know, a master warfighter. Eisenhower is looked at more as, you know, kind of a commander-in-chief, bring everybody together and make it all work. But he was ultimately the one that, when the initial stages of the Bulge were happening, nobody really took it seriously. General Bradley didn't necessarily take it seriously. It wasn't thought to be the major massive attack that it was by the Germans at first, but Eisenhower took it very seriously, and he began setting those things in motion to redeploy divisions and move divisions around and reinforce divisions. And his actions probably are what, you know, saved the whole deal. Because they otherwise, the Germans could have easily penetrated Antwerp.
Yeah.
And that would have been all she wrote. Maybe not all she wrote, but that would have set back the war at least a year or more, you know, and caused hundreds of thousands of more additional casualties versus what we already lost. Just amazing.
And that concludes episode 28A. Which is part one of our 2-part interview series with Mr. Paul Frederick, United States Marine Corps, current resident of Lexington, Kentucky. Just an amazing man, and a true honor to meet him and talk to him about his amazing story. And you know, the one thing that strikes me about Mr. Frederick, obviously his relationship with his wife for many, many years, Myrtle, which he talks about over and over again, and you just see in talking to all of these incredible heroes, you hear about their rock solid relationships throughout their lives back home with their significant others. And this is no exception, listening to Mr. Frederick talk about Myrtle and the life that they had together. And that was actually featured in the song that Jim Collins had written. And then just secondly, if you go back and you listen to all of our guests that we've had so far that have been involved in Iwo Jima, including Woody Williams himself, who was awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions on Iwo Jima. If you go back and you listen to their stories, many of them had significant periods of time where they just can't remember. They blacked out. They can't remember. It all blended together. And I know that was a long time ago. It's 77 or 78 years ago at this point. But so many of them had these time periods where they just simply can't remember because the battle was so horrific. And day in, day out, day or night, there was no getting away from the battle because the island was so small. It was well within artillery range from both sides. And then the Japanese would usually attack at night, which meant that nobody could sleep. And it was just a disaster of a situation. So it's very, very common when talking to those guys to hear them talk about how they just simply can't remember certain periods of time. And you'll see in part two, that's also the case with Mr. Frederick. I want to thank everybody for listening. Thank you so much for following our podcast. I've had the opportunity to talk to some amazing folks who have emailed me and written and corresponded online. So thank you for that. If you'd like to send us a message, please feel free. Email us walkamongheroes@gmail.com. If you'd like to follow us online, you go to our website, www.walkamongheroes.org. Like to check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/walkamongheroes, Instagram, @walkamongheroes, and you can find us on YouTube and other places. Very, very thankful for your support. We're thankful for all who have checked into Wish for Our Heroes, which is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization that we support that helps military families with basic needs. If you'd like to check them out, you can catch them at www.wishforourheroes.org. Thank you so much to all those who stand guard, protecting our way of life, our police, our firefighters, all of those here stateside, and then, of course, our military stationed around the world who sacrificed so much for all of us to give us all what we call the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. I want to thank those in the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Space Force, and everybody else standing guard around the world. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for sharing Mr. Frederick's story, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.